making TV special.
Made with creamy butter.
And you know what that means?
It's happening. I can feel it.
Yep.
This is Cascadia Public Radio.
So, as long as we're talking about the phony left-right, let's get into the phony left-right debate over re-education camps. Again, from Raw Story and Raw Replay, as well as ThinkProgress.org, The Huffington Post, and InfoWars, Representative Michelle Bachmann told KTLK's Sue Jeffers that Democrats had plans to require mandatory service from America's young people. That sounds like a crazy conspiracy theory. That couldn't be real, could it? They're not really talking about national service, are they? It's the phony left-right debate over re-education camps.
Oh, thank you. I'll tell you, I feel like I have a front row seat on history right now. I can't believe what I'm seeing. This is our country. We love our country. And I'm watching our freedom slip out the door every day. Just this week with the G20 and what President Obama is wanting to do to cede American sovereignty to transnational global authorities makes your head spin. And we as members of Congress have to bind him down with that authority. We cannot agree to these kind of things that he's wanting to do because it will just continue to take away freedom from individuals in the United States. And this is the AmeriCorps Act. And he is
Will you explain that to the listener so that they understand what it is, too?
Sure, it's under the guise of, quote, volunteerism, but it's not volunteers at all. It's paying people to do work on behalf of government. We had about 75,000 people involved in AmeriCorps before. This adds another 250,000 people, so more government employees. But what's even more concerning about it is his focus is on young people. The original language of the bill was mandatory service for government. Right now, the language is voluntary, but just this last week, a Democrat colleague introduced a bill to make this mandatory. I believe when it's all said and done, this service, I believe that there's a very strong chance that we will see that young people will be put into mandatory service. And the real concern is that there are provisions for what I would call re-education camps for young people, where young people have to go and get trained in a philosophy that the government puts forward, and then they have to go and work in some of these politically correct forums. So it's very concerning. It appears that there's a philosophical agenda behind all of this, and especially if young people are mandated to go into this. As a parent, I would have a very, very difficult time seeing my children do this. Again, a huge power grab, and it's at a cost of billions of dollars.
The phony left-right debate over re-education camps. And again, we see our misleaders and talking heads getting out in front of stories that those of us in the alternative media have been covering for a long time. Again, we see our misleaders get in front of the story, and they're able to direct and misdirect it. Again, people like Michelle Bachmann are no fucking friend of ours. But she's right. Obama and Rahm Emanuel, and even Rahm Emanuel's book called The Plan, they want mandatory national service. Again, as I've said many, many times, as the fake economy collapses on purpose, perhaps the only jobs left will be with the green brigades. Snooping on your neighbor, turning people in for maybe, you know, bumper stickers about the Constitution, or they're not doing their recycling correctly. There's going to be a lot of make-work, nanny-state green brigades going on. And again, we see the talking heads, our misleaders, they're steering this debate. It's all out there for you to read about. There's more I didn't even mention from the Minnesotan Independent on these re-education camps. And again, it's all real. And now we're into the Obamasiah updates. Banksters, Nukes, and Comic Books. First, we note from Politico that Obama's economic advisors are, of course, all linked to the banksters. Lawrence Summers, Larry Summers, top economic advisor to President Barack Obama, pulled in more than $2.7 million in speaking fees paid by firms at the heart of the financial crisis, including Citigroup, Goldman Sachs, J.P. Morgan, Merrill Lynch, Bank of America, and the now-defunct Lehman Brothers. He pulled in another $5.2 million last year from D.E. Shaw, a hedge fund for which he served as a managing director from October 06 until joining the new criminal cabinet. Thomas E. Donilon, D-O-N-I-L-O-N, Obama's deputy national security advisor, was paid $3.9 million last year by the power law firm O'Melveny & Myers to represent clients, including two firms that received federal bailout funds, Citigroup and Goldman Sachs. He's also disclosed that he's a member of the Trilateral Commission and sits on the steering committee of the super-secret Bilderberg Group. Both are favorite targets of conspiracy theorists. We should also note, of course, too, that he's a member of the Council on Foreign Relations. More links in there to Politico, as well as SourceWatch, Wikipedia, and even HistoryCommons.org. If you're a listener of the show, you know that none of that is new. We went over it from the very beginning, that all these guys coming into the criminal cabinet are either all involved in the Trilateral Commission, of course, set up by David Rockefeller and Zbigniew Brzezinski, or the Council on Foreign Relations, which, of course, Bill Clinton's mentor, Carol Quigley, wrote a big book about called Tragedy and Hope, where he noted, yes, they basically want to set up a one-world government. His only disagreement is that they wanted to keep it secret. It's in books they know you don't read. It's not a conspiracy. It's just information you don't know yet. I believe my man Richard Andrew Grove said that. Another update from the G20. G20, of course, moved the world a step closer to a global currency. That's from the Telegraph out of the UK. The G20 also supports the IMF plan to raise funds by selling 403 tons of gold. That's from MarketWatch. My Manhattan Project, how I helped build the bomb that blew up Wall Street. That's from nymag.com. House approves, of course, a $3.6 trillion budget blueprint. That's from Breitbart. And unemployment has reached 8.5%. There are 13 million jobless. That's from Yahoo Finance. However, Obama has pledged to pursue the elimination of nuclear weapons. I believe he's also selling a bridge to you. This is from the Los Angeles Times. President Obama vowed Sunday to pursue the elimination of nuclear weapons from the planet, telling a cheering throng in Prague that the U.S. is ready to lend an international effort, or rather to lead an international effort, to reduce atomic arsenals and the threat they pose. This, of course, being only hours after North Korea launched a failed multi-stage rocket. Obama, of course, also outlined that the work towards a goal that he acknowledged would be decades away. Time magazine again noting Barack Obama's New World Order. Oh, I thought that was a conspiracy. The Washington Post, of course, sees neocon hope in Obama. That's from Consortium News. Smooth criminal transition from Bush-Cheney to Obama-Biden. That's from Global Research. New World Order, still a conspiracy theory? I don't think so. The first bricks in a New World Order. That's from Financial Times of London. Again, Time Magazine, Financial Times, first bricks in the New World Order. Barack Obama's New World Order. But that's what kooks talk about. It doesn't exist. If you say you don't like it. But it does, and it's good. We've also got Obama comics. Barack the Barbarian and Drafted 100 Days. This from the Chicago Tribune. Is the presidential sword mightier than his pen? Two new comics with characters based on Obama may tell us. Drafted 100 Days and Barack the Barbarian, Quest for the Treasure of Stimuli, will feature Obama prominently on their covers and in their stories, according to Chicago-based Devil's Due Publishing. That's at devilsdue.net. Both are due out in June. The first tells the story of a leader whose future is stunted when a race from beyond the stars drafted our planet into intergalactic war. That from a company synopsis of the comic, part of the Drafted series. The book's Obama is further challenged by an injury that robs him of his greatest strength, speech. Devil's Due founder and president Josh Blaylock, an Obama fan, says the company took inspiration from a half dozen other Obama comics, including the president's appearance earlier this year with Spider-Man, as well as the president's own fondness for collecting Conan the Barbarian comics. Baraka Barbarian also includes a sword-carrying vixen with a striking resemblance to a certain former Republican vice presidential candidate. The apparent foe, Sarah Palin, is drawn wearing a chainmail bikini complete with bookish glasses and a dead wolf drape. Quest for the treasure of stimuli, indeed. You can hit the flashback back to January on MediaMonarchy.com as we go over those Obama comics, Spider-Man, and Dark Horse comics, and all the rest. Of course, we noted then that I believe a relative of Rahm Emanuel works at Dark Horse Comics, and they, of course, are facilitating the shipment of free great Conan comics to Obama. There we go. Mother Jones asks, should Obama control the Internet? Gates, of course, was planning major changes in defense programs and budgets. This was the precursor to his Monday announcement. That from the Washington Post as well, DODBuzz.com, Gates readies budget acts for Monday swipe. Russia's President Medvedev hails Comrade Obama. That's from the AFP. Obama unable to shake the Muslim myth. That's from the Washington Times. And again, Global Research asking the question, why is Obama getting a pass on the Afghanistan surge? Remember, even Bush didn't want to send a bunch more people to Afghanistan. And my man Rob left a comment at the bottom, noting, of course, that all this is the trilaterals striking again. And now it's off to the space war. North Korea, satellite proposals, and EMP. First, from the AFP, North Korea failed to put that satellite into orbit. The U.S. military on Sunday disputed North Korea's claim that it had launched a satellite into space, saying the payload itself landed in the Pacific Ocean. Stage one of the missile fell into the Sea of Japan. That said, of course, by the North American Aerospace Defense Command and U.S. Northern Command in their brief account of the North Korean rocket launch. That's, of course, NORAD and NORTHCOM. NORAD, the ones in charge of, you know, patrolling our airspace, and NORTHCOM, the ones who have brought home active duty troops to police us. The remaining stages... No, I already read that. Skipping down. No object entered orbit and no debris fell on Japan. South Korea also said the satellite, which North Korea claimed to have launched Sunday, did not enter orbit. All three stages of the rocket fell into the sea. No object entered orbit. That said by South Korean Defense Minister Lee Sang-hee, it was a failed attempt to put a satellite into orbit. Not like we missed this guy, but again, much like we're seeing things switch back around to the same phony left-right Clinton-era bullshit, Newt Gingrich is back, and what's he talking about this time? That we should attack North Korea with an electromagnetic pulse.
Let's start with today's news. Mr. Gingrich, before today's launch, you said the North Koreans should not be allowed to fire a missile and that the U.S., quote, should take whatever preemptive actions are necessary. Are you saying that President Gingrich would have taken out that missile on the launch pad?
Yes, I'm saying if you look at a new book by my co-author Bill Fortune called One Second After, and you look at electromagnetic pulse capabilities, which could take out one weapon, could take out a third of the electric generating capacity of the United States, we do not appreciate the scale of threat that is evolving on the planet, and North Korea is a totally irresponsible dictatorship run by a person who is clearly out of touch with reality. And I think to say, you know, we're now going to have another meeting of the UN to have another paper resolution that has meaningless effect is very dangerous. I think both with Iran and with North Korea, you have countries which could decide at any morning to try to actually use their weapons.
So you're saying President Gingrich would have taken out
the... There are three or four techniques that could have been used, from unconventional forces to standoff capabilities, to say, we're not going to tolerate a North Korean missile launch, period. I mean, the world's either got to decide that North Korea is utterly dangerous. And again, I'd recommend look at electromagnetic pulse, which changes every, which we've known about since 1958. It changes every equation about how risky these weapons are.
Governor Sanford, would you also have taken preemptive action? And do we really want to get into a shooting war with the North Koreans when they have a million-member army stationed just across the DMZ, about 30 miles from the South Korean capital of Seoul?
I would always defer to my former boss, if you will, as I was a top freshman, as he was speaker, on the issues of foreign policy. But what I would say is that in the countryside of South Carolina, at some point you've got to back up words with action. And as the speaker just pointed out, there have been a long series of missteps, intentional steps on North Korea's part, and little in the way of action from the standpoint of either America or international community.
Just if I could, because one last point. We have been talking about this since the Clinton administration, and they have been building nuclear weapons and building better and better missiles while we keep talking. And one morning, just like 9/11, there's going to be a disaster, and people are going to look around and say, gosh, why didn't anyone think of that? Well, I'm telling you, the time to think about it is before the disaster, not afterwards.
Well, do you think that we can do anything in the UN?
I'm looking with great interest to see the president's promise of hard action, toughness, come to this afternoon. I have yet to see the United Nations do anything effective with either Iran or North Korea.
There's another mainstream media mention of what before this would have probably been a somewhat obscure thing, and that's EMPs, electromagnetic pulses. We touched on it last week, of course, noting that possibly Obama's Obamamobile, his presidential limo, nicknamed the Beast, is perhaps protected against EMP attacks, and the BBC noted that Air Force One is protected against electromagnetic pulse attacks. Are they prepping us? Yes. Oh, and by the way, Nuke. That's a good name for him. Nuke Gingrich. Newt has gone Catholic, and he has also warned of a third party in 2012. It's interesting to note that a lot of the movers and shakers and misleaders in the world seemingly all convert to Catholicism. The question being, is that because they're at the top or near the top of the pyramid? And of course, the third party in 2012 is a fake threat. Now, of course, in the wake of all this North Korean action, this from the Wall Street Journal, satellite proposals gain traction after North Korea's launch. U.S. intel agencies are capitalizing on North Korea's weekend rocket launch to advance proposals to deploy two new spy satellite systems, estimated to cost about a total of, $10 billion. Arguing that the U.S. faces a future gap in advanced high-resolution imaging capabilities, Director of National Intelligence Dennis Blair and Defense Secretary Robert Gates last week asked the White House to approve plans to build a pair of large, cutting-edge spy satellites along with two smaller, less expensive models commercially available today. The aim is to get the simpler satellites into orbit first to maintain U.S. space surveillance efforts and then develop and launch the more capable follow-on constellation. Project Constellation. So that's North Korea, satellite proposals, and electromagnetic pulses. And that's when the drugs kicked in. Drug wars. Industrial hemp and letting drugs in. Representatives Paul and Frank introduced a bill to legalize industrial hemp. Again. This from Raw Story. One of the earliest plants domesticated by man may be on the verge of a resurge in popular production across the U.S. Industrial hemp, a non-drug variety of the cannabis plant used for centuries for its versatile fibers, is the subject of a new bill filed by Congressman Ron Paul, Republican from Texas, and Barney Frank, Democrat from Massachusetts. They and eight co-sponsors, both GOP and Lib hope to legalize the plant so American farmers can begin supplying fibers for a wide array of products, with the overreaching goal of opening a new sector in American agriculture. To view the bill's full status, full text, and list of sponsors, or to follow new developments, visit the link right there to govtrack.us for Bill 1866, the Industrial Hemp Farming Act. It is unfortunate that the federal government has stood in the way of American farmers, including many who are struggling to make ends meet, from competing in the global industrial hemp market, said Representative Ron Paul during his introduction of the bill and in a media advisory issued by an advocacy group, VoteHemp.com. Interesting to note, hit the flashback link to February of 2007, on MediaMonarchy.com, Industrial Hemp Farming Act introduced in Congress. Could go into how ridiculous it is that we don't grow hemp here. Like Bill Hicks said, it's like saying God made a mistake. But let's keep going. A new one from Dave Serrata, and again, we basically pointed out last week that the media is getting high on pot legalization. This is the truth on drugs. Any questions? Finally, a little honesty. It started with Secretary of State Hillary Clinton stating an embarrassingly obvious truth that politicians almost never discuss. In a speech about rising violence in Mexico, she said, quote, "Our insatiable demand for illegal drugs fuels the drug trade." And then added that we have a co-responsibility for the cartel-driven carnage playing out on the southern border. She's right, of course. For all the Rambo-ish talk about waging a war on drugs that interdicts the supply of narcotics, we have not diminished demand. Specifically, demand for marijuana that cartels base their business on. According to the Office of National Drug Control Policy, Americans spend about $9 billion a year on Mexican pot. The elephant in the bedroom in many discussions on the criminal justice system is the sharp increase in drug incarceration, Senator Jim Webb said in a speech recently, later telling the Huffington Post that pot legalization should be on the table. Finally, a little honesty. And now, maybe some action. As I've noted many times, we're not going to get an end to the wars for empire or the Federal Reserve or any of those things from the change agent. However, they may throw some bones in, decriminalize some pot, and maybe release some documents. Lastly, on this drug war, posting industrial hemp and letting drugs in, this from AmericanPatrol.com, the American Patrol Report. Lou Dobbs concludes that the U.S. allows drugs in. So on April 6th, Lou Dobbs agreed with the president of Mexico that drugs are flowing into the U.S. because our government permits it. President Calderon said U.S. corruption permitted drug imports.
And at the Mexican border tonight, strong words from President Felipe Calderon of Mexico in response to mounting violence in his country in a war on the drug cartel. President Calderon met with Attorney General Eric Holder and Homeland Security Secretary Janet Napolitano to talk about actions against illegal aliens, guns, and drugs. President Calderon made his position on drug trafficking crystal clear. He said that the United States is just as guilty of corruption as Mexico.
It's possible to pass guns, drugs, or cocaine to the U.S. without some grade of complicity of some American authorities. There is traffic to Mexico because there is corruption in Mexico, and that is true. But with the same argument, if there is traffic in the United States, it's because there is some corruption in the United States.
I don't often agree with President Calderon on any issue. This time I have to. There is no other explanation that goes well beyond indifference and apathy to the fact that this country has tolerated that border being violated by drug traffickers who bring in, from Mexico, methamphetamine, heroin, cocaine, and marijuana. In fact, Mexico is the largest source. And for us as a nation to have tolerated the immense loss of life, the devastation of life, through addiction to drugs, most of which, again, originated in Mexico, can only be explained by corruption.
Lou Dobbs is right. There is corruption, but it is mainly political. Drugs are allowed into the country because the ruling class is willing to sacrifice its citizens on the altar of globalism. American Border Patrol has shown that the new border fence began cutting off smuggling routes, and that led to the Mexican drug war. But the establishment doesn't want the fence, so they blacked out ABP and its reports, and that includes those who run Lou Dobbs Tonight. There's something even worse, but more on that later, says AmericanPatrol.com. Let's hit the skies. Let's get high now. As U.S. fighter jets scrambled to intercept a stolen plane. This from Reuters with links to The Times Online as well as NORAD themselves. A pilot stole a small airplane in Canada on Monday and headed south, forcing U.S. military officials to scramble F-16 fighter jets to trail him before landing on a highway in Missouri and fleeing on foot. The pilot was captured and arrested by Missouri state troopers a short time after landing the Cessna 172. Lieutenant Commander Gary Ross of the North American Aerospace Defense Command said the plane was not believed to be a terrorist threat nor a threat to civilians. Still, the state capital in Madison, Wisconsin, was evacuated as a precaution while the plane was in its area. Two updates. First, from the Canadian Spectator. Plane joyride into the U.S. called a suicide attempt. A flight student suspected of stealing a plane in Canada and flying erratically across three states in an apparent bid to commit suicide by getting shot down by the U.S. military was described as a nice kid who didn't seem unhappy. His name, Adam Leon, 31, arrested at a convenience store in Elsinore, Missouri, shortly after a pilot landed the single-engine four-seat Cessna on a rural Missouri road following a wild scramble involving U.S. F-16s. The second update from the Associated Press, NORAD said that shooting down the stolen plane was not considered. The agency charged with defending North American airspace never seriously considered shooting down a rogue pilot who flew into U.S. airspace because it quickly determined that he had no hostile intent. Defense officials quickly learned that the pilot was Adam Leon, who, was born Yavuz Berk in Turkey before moving to Canada and becoming a naturalized citizen. Y-A-V-U-Z-B-E-R-K-E, Yavuz Berk. He didn't threaten population centers and didn't appear to be threatening critical infrastructure. And then you don't want to provoke someone into doing something they weren't going to do in the first place by taking some sort of aggressive posture. So the spokesman for NORAD said the decision to shoot down goes to the president or the secretary of defense. If both are unavailable, a group within NORAD can decide. So U.S. fighter jets scrambled to intercept the stolen plane.
I want to bring you some more information briefly concerning some breaking news that we reported during Fox 11 News at 5 from Madison, where the state capitol has been evacuated. It followed a warning from defense officials mid-afternoon. About 2 o'clock this afternoon, the North American Aerospace Defense Commander, NORAD, dispatched a couple of F-16 fighter jets to track a single-engine plane, a Cessna 172, that was flying over Wisconsin. Authorities say they believe the plane had been stolen by a student pilot earlier in the afternoon from Thunder Bay, Canada. State capital was evacuated around 5 o'clock this afternoon, about an hour ago, as a precaution. Right now, authorities believe the pilot of the stolen plane has not yet communicated with the fighters, but they say they do not believe that this is any kind of a terror threat. Again, the capital was evacuated as a precaution. Madison's Air National Guard unit does fly F-16s. We don't know if that's where the fighter jet came from, but two F-16 fighter jets were scrambled this afternoon by NORAD because of a suspicious flying single-engine plane over the Madison area. At last report, about 5:30, the plane was a few miles southwest of Madison.
These are the pilot's final moments of freedom inside a Missouri convenience store where he was handcuffed by police. Investigators say Adam Leon had a death wish, that he flew this single-engine plane deep into United States airspace, hoping that fighter jets would shoot him down. It's a profile of a pilot his friends simply cannot believe.
I have no idea what he was trying to do. Probably just like a joy flight or an adrenaline rush.
Even the president of the flight school where Leon was a student, where he stole the plane for his suicidal mission, praises the young pilot.
He was very personable, very polite, very engaged in class, asked lots of questions, so this came as a total surprise to everyone.
Leon flew for 6 hours before he safely landed the plane on that rural highway in southern Missouri. F-16 fighter pilots were trailing him the entire way.
You could tell there was a single person in the aircraft. Kind of waved at me, actually.
What made Leon snap? He told investigators he has not felt like himself lately and has been treated recently by a psychiatrist. Leon is now in federal custody here in St. Louis, and he likely will not be going home anytime soon. He faces charges that could land him in federal prison for up to a decade. For Good Morning America, Ryan Owens, ABC News, St. Louis.
Ah, we find out there that he had been seeing a psychiatrist. And I, of course, forgot to note earlier as we were covering all the murder and mayhem and shooting sprees that, of course, those who live through them, I'm sure we always like to find out that they've had ties with some strange psychiatric outfit or, of course, are on mind-bending psychotropic drugs. So that's Adam Leon or Yavuz Burke stealing a plane, making NORAD scramble F-16s to chase him down. My, that segues quite nicely into our latest 9/11 updates. So there we have NORAD scrambling quickly to get on top of that jet. However, gee, it seems like on 9/11 they just weren't so quick to do that. But of course, with all the terror and war game drills going on, you know, most of the military and F-16s were somewhere over Canada. But I digress. You can make the connections for yourself as we go into this next story. From Paul Joseph Watson. Military whistleblower claims she witnessed Flight 93 shoot-down order. A woman who claims she was stationed at Fort Meade, that's in Maryland, and that's the home of the NSA. A woman who claims she was stationed at Fort Meade on 9/11 has given an explosive interview about how she personally heard military commanders make the decision to shoot down United Airlines Flight 93 on 9/11. A person using the pseudonym Elizabeth Nelson told the Project Camelot website, projectcamelot.org, that she personally heard officials agree on the order to shoot down Flight 93. The decision was apparently made because the plane was flying in a no-fly zone to Camp David and heading toward Site R, a military facility in the know known as the Backup Pentagon. Elizabeth Nelson stresses that at no time was there any talk of hijackers, and the plane was shot down purely because communication had been lost and standard operating procedure mandated that the plane be intercepted and destroyed. Because the woman refuses to provide her real name, the authenticity of her story is very much up for debate. But in a 40-minute MP3 recording, with the link for you to download it, it's 30-meg, 40-minute MP3 of the interview, she relates what she witnessed in a sincere and genuine way as one could expect. This individual, Elizabeth Nelson, has seemingly little to gain from making up such a story unless it's part of a deliberate disinformation campaign. Elizabeth Nelson, military whistleblower, claims she witnessed the shoot-down order for Flight 93.
And we stood there, me and him and two other soldiers. We looked at the TV, and you could see the smoke coming out of the building, and at that moment, I saw the next plane coming crash into the other tower. So now both towers were hit. And we all were just absolutely silent. You know, we knew what this meant. I do not know the names and names of the people in the room. I do know that it was, at the time, the head commander of the hospital, and I believe the commander of the base. Plane that was flying in a no-fly zone near to Camp David. and heading towards Site R. They had no idea what Site R was, and to me, Camp David was a place where George Bush went on vacation. Didn't know any more than that. Protocol is that this is a no-fly zone. We have to take this plane down. Yes, it's a passenger plane. It needs to be taken down. And so I was in this room when the decision was mutually made by the people talking on the phone in the room that I was in to shoot this plane down. Site R is an underground city under a mountain in Pennsylvania. We have just a little bit of time to decide before it's too late. You could feel the intensity in this room, you know? I mean, and these men weren't heartless men. I remember the distinct feeling inside of me when I saw in the news that there was a story that there were terrorists on this plane and that the people overtook the pilot and crashed the plane so that... and how this was leaking out of these people being heroes. And I remember the extreme moral frustration inside of me. A feeling like, but that's not true. That's not true at all.
Amazing new developments in the crumbling cover-up of the official story of 9/11. Military whistleblower claims she witnessed Flight 93 shoot-down order. Of course, there are many links in here for you to do the research yourself. So we link to historycommons.org as well as 9/11 research, as well as WorldNet Daily, as well as Project Camelot, as well as Killtown. Of course, Killtown has done amazing work on all angles of 9/11. So you should hit his link to killtown.911review.org, and you will go down the rabbit hole. That's the first of two huge new developments. The other, scientists find active super thermite in the World Trade Center dust. It's from Raw Story, who I, of course, have mentioned many times, are closet 9/11 truthers. A team of nine scientists has unearthed startling data from dust gathered in the days and weeks after the World Trade Center towers collapsed on 9/11. They discovered that scattered throughout the dust samples were red and gray chips of active thermitic material or an unreacted pyrotechnic explosive. Thermite is used in steel welding, fireworks shows, and hand grenades. It's the combination of a metal powder and a metal oxide, which produce a reaction known for extremely high temperatures, focused in a very small area for a short period of time. The active thermitic material discovered in the World Trade Center dust was a combination of elemental aluminum and iron oxide, and is a form of thermite known as nanostructured superthermite. A quote from the report: these observations reminded us of nanothermite fabricated at the Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory and elsewhere. Available papers describe this material as an intimate mixture of UFG, ultra-fine grain aluminum, and iron oxide, and nanothermite composites to form pyrotechnics or explosives. Commercially available thermite behaves as an incendiary when ignited, but when the ingredients are ultra-fine grain and are intimately mixed, this nanothermite reacts very rapidly, even explosively, and is sometimes referred to as superthermite. Now we'll note that the full article in the Open Chemical Physics Journal can be downloaded with a link for you. We also have interviews and documentation thanks to Visibility911.com and Michael Wolsey with his two new interviews covering this new peer-reviewed paper. Scientists find active superthermite in WTC dust. So recently Kevin Ryan and Dr. Stephen Jones were guests on Visibility 911. Continuing. Some of the authors of the paper have lost their jobs at universities and chemistry labs for their outspoken breakdown of what happened at the World Trade Center on 9/11. Kevin Ryan lost his job as a lab director after writing a letter to the National Institute for Standards and Technology NIST was conducting an investigation into 9/11 at the time, he wrote a letter challenging the common theory that burning jet fuel weakened the steel supports holding up the 110-story skyscrapers. Kevin Ryan claims that the owner of his laboratory subsidiary was the company that certified the steel components used in the construction of the WTC buildings. This according to the South Bend Tribune, with a link for you. Dr. Stephen E. Jones, a physicist at Brigham Young University, presented a paper in 2005 discussing alternative theories to the commonly accepted jet fuel reasoning. In September 06, he was placed on administrative leave, and his paper was removed from the BYU database. Stephen Jones has told Visibility911.com, quote, "In short, the paper explodes the official story that no evidence exists for explosive pyrotechnic materials in the WTC buildings. Parts of the report mention other studies being conducted by the scientists that will come out soon." I've been saying for quite some time that perhaps studying the obviously suspicious collapses of all the buildings on 9/11 maybe isn't the best way to go in 9/11 truth. I've often compared it now to the Obama birther issue. It's the story that gets a lot of attention, but does it actually go anywhere? Again, links and links and links within this story, the Deseret News, and again, Raw Story and other places. What is fortunate and why I'm happy to cover this story is that this is peer-reviewed scientific journals. This isn't website quackery. So we'll be interested to see how much more coverage this super thermite in the WTC dust story gets. One last related headline hanging out at the bottom of this posting from IrishCentral.com. Somebody please rescue me from 9/11 conspiracy theories. Of course, the TV show Rescue Me, now in its fifth season, going further and further into 9/11 conspiracies. And it's always only a hop, skip, and a jump from the terror op, black op drills of 9/11 to July 5th, 2007, the London bombings. 7/7. So July 7th, 2005. Peter Power reveals more details of the 7/7 terror drills. We'll explain a little bit more of who this guy is and what we've hit before, way in the past on MediaMonarchy.com, but from Steve Watson, Peter Power, which would, of course, be a great porno name. Peter Power, the former Scotland Yard official, anti-terrorist branch official, who oversaw drills of the very events of the London bombings on the morning of 7/7 as they were happening, has revealed more details behind the events for the first time in 3.5 years. A statement, apparently from Mr. Power, has appeared in the comments section of a recent blog posting regarding comments Power made on the BBC last week. Those comments, that comment posting, is on uncensored.co.nz out of New Zealand. But as was recently highlighted by the InfoWars team, the crisis management expert, Peter Power, revealed that some companies used the shutdown of the City of London last Wednesday during the G20 protest as a dress rehearsal for an influenza pandemic.
Joined here by the former Metropolitan Police Inspector Peter Power, who set up the Gulf Mile strategy in the mid-1980s, now a crisis management consultant. Peter, Scotland Yard saying they have 5,000 police on duty in London today. I mean, it is quite a headache with just the number of protests they're actually having handled today.
It's not so unusual, bearing in mind the Met Police has a lot of experience in this, but I think what we're looking at in the pictures is much more carnival than riot. There have been some worrying glitches coming up. For example, we've been looking at pictures of an armoured vehicle that was stopped, with people wearing helmets and overalls. But it's interesting also that on that vehicle were not the words police, they didn't try to be police, then they used the word riot. had they found in there, had the police found in there things like gas masks, mats to building, lots of food and water, suggesting a long siege type thing, they would be much more worried. But you have to remember that there are more American banks in the city than there are in the whole of New York. And something like 20% of UK GDP comes in London as a whole. So there are some potential targets there. But so far, there's always a danger that this may become a self-fulfilling prophecy. Police have been talking up the likelihood of protest. That's an extrapolation of intelligence. But things may happen simply because streets have been boarded up, windows have been boarded up, which is almost like saying, come on, riot. And that's a danger.
But in a sense, they have no option in terms of you have to police this, you have to police the numbers. And you have, of course, all these world leaders in the capital. It is a lot to juggle for.
Yes, it is. But there are, you know, in terms of geography, you've got Excel, which is going to resemble an old castle with a moat around it. Because anybody who knows Excel knows it's surrounded by water. Then there are all the routes to it. And then there are where people are staying overnight. So it's a real headache. But, you know, for the men and women who are working in London today, they must also be looking at their own business continuity plans, these plans about if they have to stop work suddenly, what do they do? And some companies are using today as a rehearsal for the 2012 Olympics, how they might respond, or even how they might respond for pandemic influenza, that means working from home. So some people are being quite ambitious about using today to test their own resources.
I mentioned in the introduction that you have set up the Gold Mine strategy that we're sort of seeing played out. I mean, broadly, what is that strategy? How do you approach innovators?
Well, this is quite interesting. Unlike, say, the King's Cross fire way back in 1987, which suddenly happened, events like this are known in advance. So gold is a title given to the person who thinks strategically, sets the policy and the strategy. That would have been done weeks ago. Silver, and maybe more than one, literally directs things on the ground. And silver actually can often be in the same room as gold, but their roles differ. And it was a very impressive command center, Lambeth. There are two rooms, in fact, side by side. And bronzes are all the call signs given to the officers, doing precise tasks. Every piece does use it. So what we're seeing here is a set piece action, and possibly the least important purple, or the least busy, could actually be gold. Because the promise has been set, and now it's going to be down to the silvers and the bronzes.
So let's not get confused. That was Peter Power talking recently on the BBC about how private companies were using the G20 chaos as a cover for drills about a pandemic, or, of course, how to deal with the 2012 London Olympics. Returning to the article. In response to an explanation of who Peter Power is, which was added by the Uncensored magazine blog, Mr. Power himself posted a lengthy statement in which he reveals that the company he was working with on 7-7 was London-based information giant Reed Elsevier. That's R-E-E-D-E-L-S-E-V-I-E-R. Reed Elsevier, or Elsevier. The company is most notable for its ownership of LexisNexis. LexisNexis, basically the private Google. And, of course, many other information sources. As Elsevier, it runs a vast number of science journals, including some of the biggest and most reputable ones. Reed is also known as a host of large exhibitions. The company part owns the Excel Center in London's Docklands area, where the G20 summit was held on the 1st and 2nd. To recap the situation, on the afternoon of July 7th, 2005, Peter Power told a BBC radio interviewer that his company was running an exercise for an unnamed group that revolved around three bombs going off at precisely the same tube stations and precisely the same time as those that were hit that morning. Flashback links in there to Global Research, as well as Prison Planet, as well as even the Wikipedia entry for Reed Elsevier. And a nice update on this from ITN. UK police ordered to release 7-7 footage. Police have been ordered to release footage of the July 7th bombers after a three-year freedom of information battle. The video shows the terrorists chatting, putting on rucksacks and buying snacks on their way to carry out suicide bombings that killed 52 innocent people in London. In chilling scenes, Hasib Hussein is also seen shopping for a battery and stopping at McDonald's as he struggles to make his device work after the other bombs have been detonated. The footage was described in detail in the Home Office's narrative report, which was published the year after the devastating 2005 attacks. Think of it as the 9/11 Commission report. With a link for you to the BBC's breakdown of the Home Office's narrative report. But very little of the material has so far been made available to the public. The Information Commissioner overruled objections from Scotland Yard that disclosure could disrupt its investigations and ordered that 7 pieces of footage should be released. The force has 35 days to either appeal or disclose. 3 of the bombers detonated their devices almost simultaneously at 8:50 a.m. Lindsay under King's Cross, that's Jermaine Lindsay, Mohammed Sadiq Khan at Edgware Road, and Shahzad Tanweer at Aldgate. Hussein set off his bomb on a bus in Tavistock Square at 9:47 a.m. The commissioner ruled that the faces of anyone other than the bomber should be pixelated in the footage. You can read all the Wikipedia entries for all those supposed bombers. And again, hit links to historycommons.org to read more about the 7/7 bombings. The flashback, Peter Power fleeing from a We Are Change confrontation, that goes back to December of 2007. Again, the headline, Peter Power reveals more details of the 7/7 terror drills. There were drills going on the morning of 7/7 where the exact same buses and trains in the exact same times and places as in the drills happened in real life. The odds are impossible. On 9/11, there were, in some reports, as many as 18 war games and terror drills going on, many of which involving hijacked planes crashing into buildings. That's why we watch all the crazy terror drills, whether it's the top-off terror drills in Portland, which of course had some bomb scare in the middle of the drill where a bomb-sniffing dog smelled bomb residue on a vehicle in the Lloyd Center, a football field or two away from where I live. That's why we watch the drills. The government isn't behind it all. It's compartmentalized. Good people are doing their job, but sometimes they don't know what their job is. So those are some of the latest developments on the 9/11 7/7 terror ops. So let's go to the woods. Let's go to the redwoods. More specifically, let's sneak in to the Bohemian Grove. We mentioned a while ago, of course, the new issue of Vanity Fair, with Giselle, what's-her-name on the cover, of course, her recent marriage to football guy Brady, where perhaps their entourage fired upon paparazzi photographers, as Costa Rican police are investigating. The new issue of Vanity Fair has an article called Bohemian Tragedy. Just the first blurb intro for you. Members of the ultra-exclusive Bohemian Club, 2,500 of America's richest, most conservative men, including Henry Kissinger, George H.W. Bush, and a passel of Bechtels, Bases, and Rockefellers, are known to urinate freely against the ancient redwoods that cover their 2,700-acre property. Have they been chopping down the trees as well? According to one former member turned whistleblower, the San Francisco-based society may have logged some of its old-growth forest. Drawing on his own Ivy League ties, the author investigates with a daring sortie into the ceremonial kickoff of the Bohemians' annual encampment. So the story is basically about how these guys who own this grove are actually doing illegal logging of ancient, beautiful redwoods. The flashback to MediaMonarchy.com, July 2008. Vanity Fair editor arrested at Bohemian Grove. They were working on this story. then. They snuck in the July 2008 Bohemian Grove get-together, and of course we're coming up soon, July, to the Bohemian Grove 2009. Another flashback. We've covered both of these angles on MediaMonarchy.com, going all the way back to May of 2008. Bohemian Grove to cut trees for cash. An interesting note as well, and a web exclusive, not actually in the Vanity Fair issue, only on VanityFair.com, a guide to the Bohemian Grove. Conspiracy theorists believe the Bohemian Grove's idyllic grounds in Northern California are host to right-wing old boy machinations about the New World Order. Honorary member Richard Nixon, meanwhile, called it the most faggy goddamn thing you could ever imagine. For Vanity Fair contributing editor Alex Shumatoff, who was arrested for trespassing at last year's encampment while investigating the club's forestry practices, the most suspicious activity that takes place in the grove is the alleged logging of old-growth redwood trees. But common to all reports from the two-week-long gathering of the country's rich and powerful old guard, members have included every Republican president since Coolidge, is an account of profuse outdoor urination. With gin fizzes being poured at 7 a.m., so many enlarged prostates and such majestic natural urinals, who's surprised? So, Vanity Fair is proud to present to you a guide to the Bohemian Grove, including a map of the premises, highlights of the events, and a list of prominent members and regular guests going back to the club's founding in 1872 to today. The last flashback link to Media Monarchy, July 2008, Bohemian Grove 2008 guest list revealed. And there are many links in here to Prison Planet, as well as Dark Secrets Inside Bohemian Grove on Google Video, as well as Gawker.com. And again, they'll talk about these things, but they do it in a way to make fun of it. And just say, oh, it's just, you know, a bunch of old white guys peeing on trees and ha ha ha. They couldn't actually be performing mock druidic rituals and deciding the course of the New World Order, or at least disseminating the information to their level of the pyramid, and it mockingbirds down. One anonymous posting to this Bohemian tragedy, a good compliment to Alex Shumatov's article, Bohemian Tragedy, is the website savebohemiangrove.org for the latest on the logging controversy and how you can help. savebohemiangrove.org. My friends, you're so good staying all this way through me on this supersized episode 118 of MediaMonarchy.com, coming to you April 10th, Bad Friday 2009, from the studios of the Portland Radio Authority. We're almost there. And so to, you know, sort of reward you and congratulate you for making it this far into the show, we're going to listen to a little bit of music, which is also going to give me a little break and also set the stage for the Food World Order. Everyone's at it. Lily Allen. That's the lead-off track from her new record, It's Not Me, It's You. And that's the second cut I've played for you a couple months ago when the record first came out. We played The Fear. I think The Fear and Everyone's at It, that's both the first two tracks on the record, I think, are the best tracks on the record. Those are the two that get into the society and the culture, whether it's celebrity drugs or pharmaceutical drugs. Everyone's at it, and The Fear are both, I think, amazing and sort of deceptive, catchy pop tunes that when you listen to them, you're saying, oh, everyone's prescribing themselves antidepressants, and everyone's on it, and we can't talk about it. The rest of the songs on the record are good, but they're more sort of relationship folks, and of course don't really have much of a place here on Media Monarchy. That sets the table for the Food World Order. Foodworldorder.com, as I've mentioned several times now, is my new embryonic website covering enviro health and the agricultural new world order, or the agricultural industrial complex. This was also, as I mentioned, the topic of my most recent interview with James Corbett of CorbettReport.com on his forthcoming episode 83 called Food World Order. I will, of course, post that up for you as soon as that show is available. But turning to FoodWorldOrder.com, we've got to run down several postings that we have not covered on the show here. Illegal drug tests and vaccine scams. First, a headline, unsafe food, GMO proliferation bills in the U.S. Congress. That is from Global Research. And again, more wicked, terrible legislation coming to us from the 111th Congress. However, from EcoChildsPlay.com, $75 million settlement from Pfizer over illegal drug trials. drug company giant Pfizer has agreed to settle out of court to the tune of $75 million in the case of its unlicensed medical trials on Nigerian children during a meningitis outbreak in 1996, which led to 11 deaths and serious injuries such as organ failure and brain damage in others. The Nigerian Health Ministry called the experiment an illegal trial of an unregistered drug and a clear case of exploitation of the ignorant. Pfizer tested their experimental antibiotic Trovan, T-R-O-V-A-N, on children without the consent of their parents in the midst of an outbreak that ultimately killed 11,000, claiming it was a humanitarian mission. The drug company stated that the trial was conducted ethically and with the permission of the Nigerian government, but both claims have been disputed. If Pfizer's going to cough up $75 million for a settlement, one wonders what would have come out in court. The drug was never approved for U.S. children, but the FDA gave the green light to its use in adults in 98. Trovan was banned in the EU in 99, and the FDA restricted its use severely after liver failures were reported in adults. Now for the media tie-in. The Constant Gardener, the book by John le Carré, which of course was turned into the film starring Ralph Fiennes. The Constant Gardener by John le Carré was reportedly inspired by the events of 1996, but set in Kenya instead of Nigeria. Another headline, naturalnews.com notes that chemicals used to disinfect water create dangerous toxins, but another illegal vaccine scam, more human experimentation, of course, testing drugs and vaccines and God knows what else, and of course, the poorest and brownest among us. Health workers on trial for vaccine scam in Poland. This from the agency French Press. 9 health workers went on trial in northern Poland Monday, accused of having tested a vaccine against bird flu on nearly 200 patients without their knowledge. The accused, 3 doctors, 6 nurses, charged with, quote, fraud, creating false documents, and delivering health care without authorization to 196 patients, Judge Peter Zadowski told, or rather of the Torun region told the AFP. If found guilty, they risk up to 10 years in jail. All 9 accused, some reportedly clad in wigs and sunglasses to avoid being identified, pleaded not guilty. The medical personnel are charged with administering a vaccine banned in Poland against the deadly H5N1 strain of bird flu that can be transmitted to humans. The patients were paid for the vaccines, Polish news agency PAP reported. They allegedly let their patients, many of them poor and homeless, or rather, they led their patients, many of them poor and homeless, to believe they were being vaccinated against the ordinary flu. Police discovered the scam by chance when they were called to break up a fight at a homeless shelter. This isn't new at all. Check out Alabama's Tuskegee syphilis experiments, where they, in some cases, gave black men syphilis, and in other cases, told them they were just treating their syphilis, but they were basically letting them die and studying them as they did it. You should also Google pesticides tested on foster children, or, hell, read about the ringworm children. Read about how radiating little Israeli kids. None of this is new. And again, it's part of the eugenics op. Perchlorate chemicals found in 100% of tested infant formula. Again, that's from Natural News, and that leads us to the next posting. Rocket fuel chemical found in baby formula. This from the Associated Press. Traces of a chemical used in rocket fuel were found in samples of powdered baby formula and could exceed what's considered a safe dose for adults if mixed with water also contaminated with the ingredient. The study by scientists at the U.S. Centers for Disease Control looked for the chemical perchlorate in different brands of powdered baby formula. It was published last month but the Environmental Working Group, EWG.org, a Washington, D.C.-based advocacy organization, issued a press release last Thursday drawing attention to it. The chemical has turned up in several cities' drinking water supplies. It can occur naturally, but most perchlorate contamination has been tied to defense and aerospace sites. So, again, we mentioned that update from Natural News. Perchlorate chemicals found in 100% of tested infant formula. The AP doesn't say that. The next post, water wars, recalls, factory farms, and food stamps. First the headline, growing your own food, green, cheap, and delicious. That's from eatdrinkbetter.com. From sustainablog.org, they're covering the new documentary called Flow, documenting the global water crisis. So, host of the podcast from Sustainablog, as well as flowthefilm.com, as well as even the Wired report about the film at Sundance. Wired called it the scariest movie at the Sundance Film Festival. Host of the podcast that we have a clip for, you can download the 15-meg interview with the director of Flow, talks with Irina Salina, director of the documentary Flow, How Did a Handful of Corporations Steal Our Water? And they talk about the global water crisis and her experience making the film. Wired, of course, referred to the documentary as the scariest movie at Sundance in 2008. The Telegraph notes that the UK might start food rationing unless you cut back on your water footprint. Water wars, coming soon. Pistachio recall. Is anything safe to eat anymore? And again, from eatdrinkbetter.com, the writer notes that after my family and I enjoyed several handfuls of pistachios at a get-together last weekend, I was surprised to hear about the latest food recall. Federal food officials are warning Americans to avoid any food containing pistachios because of possible salmonella contamination, just like the recent problems with peanuts. All this food recalling makes a person wonder if anything is really safe to eat anymore. Links in there to MSNBC, EcoChildsPlay.com, and even YouTube. Something I go into in my talk with James Corbett about the food world order is that I work at a grocery store, and I, of course, have been seeing the recalls firsthand. Problem, reaction, solution. I worry, so is it going to be a food 9/11? Is it going to be a cyber 9/11? God knows what. But it will be a catalyzing event. You can bet on it. There's a strange video and a link for you from DETnews.com to the Urban Hunter. The next meal is just scampering by. That's a strange one. And they go talk to the raccoon man. And you can guess what he does. There's another one about antibiotics being misused on factory farms. That's from livablefutureblog.com. And lastly, from Reuters, food stamp list swells to a record 32 million. A record 32.2 million people, one in every 10 Americans, received food stamps at the latest count. The government said last Thursday, a reflection of the recession now in its 16th month. Which I think, actually, by definition, may actually make that a depression. Food stamps, the major U.S. anti-hunger program, help poor people buy groceries. The average benefit was $112.82 per person in January. The January figure marks the third time in 5 months that enrollment set a record. The last posting we're going to go over on the Food World Order. Monsanto's GMO corn harvest fails massively in South Africa. This from Digital Journal. South African farmers suffered millions of dollars in lost income when 82,000 hectares of genetically manipulated corn failed to produce hardly any seeds. The plants look lush and healthy from the outside. Monsanto has offered compensation. Monsanto blames the failure of the three varieties of corn planted on these farms in three South African provinces on alleged under-fertilization processes in the laboratory. Some 280 of the 1,000 farmers who planted the three varieties of Monsanto corn this year have reported extensive seedless corn problems. However, environmental activist Marion Mayette, M-A-Y-E-T, director of the Africa Center for Biosecurity in Johannesburg, demands an urgent government investigation and an immediate ban on all GM foods, blaming the crop failure on Monsanto's genetically manipulated technology. The update and the breakdown on this comes from naturalnews.com. A crop failure highlights dangers of food supply domination. Worry is building over the effects of the Food Safety and Modernization Act of 2009, otherwise known as H.R. 875. This is the bill currently working its way through Congress that would effectively hand over control of America's food supply to such nefarious giants as Monsanto and lesser counterparts such as Tyson Foods and Cargill. We have a right to worry because broad interpretation of this bill reveals its potential to put an end to healthy food in America. I could discuss more of the Food World Order, but all I'll say here is foodworldorder.com is my new blog, and you should send me an email at mediamonarchy@yahoo.com. I could perhaps be interested in taking on some editing help on the new website, hopefully getting some other hands involved. Many hands make for light work. The last two bits on this amazing, supersized episode 118 of MediaMonarchy.com are two brutal, deadly anniversaries. First, early evening, April 4th, a shot rang out in the Memphis sky. Bono, of course, was wrong again. He says early morning, April 4th. It was in the evening. But it's the death of Martin Luther King Jr. 41 years later. So there are links. You can watch a documentary about why King was assassinated, but a quick blurb from BrassCheckTV.com notes that every year, Martin Luther King's contribution to the moral character of the United States becomes clearer and clearer. What also becomes clearer and clearer is the power and ruthlessness of the forces he was opposing. The probability that King was killed by forces within the U.S. government becomes clearer every day, too. The elite's worst fear is that people will overlook minor racial and social differences and not only understand how they're being screwed, but also join together to do something about it. No one had a clearer voice on this subject than King, which is why his life was snuffed out. BrassCheckTV.com, as well as InthPosition.com, and you can even go to Google Books and check out the preview of Dr. William F. Pepper's book, An Act of State. A couple side notes to this. Of course, Skull and Bones Life magazine exclusive newly released photos reveal aftermath of King's assassination. Also links to The Guardian as well as the aforementioned Life magazine, which was started by Henry Luce of Skull and Bones, which of course bought the Zapruder film and many other photos and documentations that they store away. Perhaps as badges. BlackStarNews.com notes that King, President Obama, and Imperial America, there's a lot of work to do there. Martin Luther King, Obama, and Imperial America. Has Obama ever said anything even remotely approaching, even close to what Martin Luther King was doing? Martin Luther King may not have been perfect. He may have had sexual dalliances and other things. But he was against the Vietnam War. He was against war, and he was non-violent. Flashbacks to MediaMonarchy.com. 2008, the 40th anniversary of MLK's assassination, as well as August 2007, The Dream is Still Alive. early evening, April 4th, the death of MLK 41 years later. The second deadly anniversary. 15 years later, the death of Kurt Cobain. Where, of course, we note that just because you're paranoid, don't mean they're not after you. This from DigitalJournal.com. It's been 15 years now since 27-year-old Kurt Cobain ran away from a treatment center in L.A., flew to his heart's home in Seattle, and first shot himself up with heroin, and then shot himself with a shotgun. Kurt Cobain was just one of the long line of 27-year-old rock stars to blaze like a shooting star through Earth's atmosphere to gloriously high heights, only to extinguish themselves mostly and die at a tender age. Brian Jones, Jimi Hendrix, Janis Joplin, Jim Morrison, he was in good company indeed. However, as we all know, Cobain was a tortured soul who was a bipolar and suffered from manic depression. He was also a drug addict who had run away from the Exodus Recovery Center a few days before, and after administering a lethal dose of heroin to himself, took a shotgun that a friend had bought for him just days prior, put it under his chin, and pulled the trigger. We note in there a link to the book by Alex Constantine, The Covert War Against Rock. I should also note a big thanks to Alex Constantine, who has recently added a link to MediaMonarchy.com on his many websites, alexconstantine.blogspot.com, and some of the others. I can't get the URLs straight right now. Blacklist is another one of them. Alex Constantine's Blacklist. So again, thanks to Alex Constantine. And again, my friends, thanks to you. You've made it all the way to the end of this supersized episode 118 of MediaMonarchy.com. And that's right, it's time for the list of creepy customers coming to MediaMonarchy.com in the past week. I track the visits to the website through StatCounter.com. And we look and see who's visiting the sites and how they're getting there, perhaps who's linking to the sites, or perhaps what they're searching, and maybe who and where and what they are. Many of the results, the majority of the results, are people searching things on Google from their home. So a lot of the search results are, you know, Comcast or Cox or Time Warner Cable, and it's just people Googling things. The far more interesting things is, of course, that private organizations or businesses or schools usually have their own internet service provider, so you can see the name of who it is. Let's get to it. The Mohawk College of Applied Arts and Technologies Googled embedded messages. FEMA, out of Springfield, Missouri, reading about FEMA covering up the cancer risks to Katrina victims. We had the DoD Network Information Center visiting out of Columbus, Ohio. We had Motorola General Systems Group out of Chicago Google William Bennett, CIA. The death of William Bennett. CIA, contract killers, and Kosovo questions we covered last week, and that was the ex-CIA contractor who, while jogging with his wife in Loudoun County, Virginia, just a few weeks ago, was beaten to death. We discovered later he was a CIA contractor. He was connected to the bombings in Kosovo and perhaps even connected to CIA covert operations with Slobodan Milosevic's death squads. That last part's speculative, but again, I like to watch who visits from StatCounter, because when it's folks from the inside, it's interesting to see what stories are important. And those are the ones that lead the spooks to MediaMonarchy.com. So, there, that was just Motorola Googling William Bennett, CIA. But we also had visits from Shell Services International out of Houston, as well as Wachovia out of Richmond, Virginia, or, as we like to say, watch over ya. The manufacturer's life insurance company out of Toronto, Ontario, Googled Project Bluebeam. The BBC out of London Googled William Bennett, CIA. We had a visit from the Ministry of Justice from The Hague in Netherlands, where, of course, Slobodan Milosevic was sitting on trial until he died. Zurich American Insurance Company out of Schaumburg, Illinois, Googled William Bennett, CIA. The Metropolitan Jewish Health System out of New York City Googled William Bennett, CIA. The University of Cambridge out of the UK Googled William Bennett, CIA. The United States Department of State out of Washington, D.C. Googled Foreign Policy, William Bennett, CIA. Credit Suisse out of Zurich, Switzerland Googled William Bennett, CIA. Again, the Navy Network Information Center, this time out of Pensacola, Florida, Googled Obama speech backwards. Our old friends at the Drug Enforcement Administration and out of Arlington, Virginia, always makes a visit every week, multiple times, to MediaMonarchy.com. Again, the United States Department of State Googled Bennett, Lansdowne, China, CIA. Lansdowne is the community in Virginia where ex-CIA contractor William Bennett was mysteriously beaten to death by three people in a white van. Booz Allen Hamilton out of Arlington, Virginia. We've noted them before. They're one of the great players in the private military contracting scheme. They Googled Bill McWilliams, North Albany, Oregon. Bill McWilliams is a local JFK researcher. We also had Wyden and Kennedy right out of Portland, Oregon. And finally, the Department of Homeland Security out of Springfield, Virginia, Googled Universal Adversary. Universal Adversary, it's important to note, was the fictional terror group contained within the terror drill known as Top Off 4 and performed right here in Portland, Oregon. I don't know what else to say other than thank you so much for getting in contact with me, for talking about what's going on in the world, for sharing the links, for sending me news, for sharing the website, for getting the show, for getting it out, for rebroadcasting it, pirate radio, internet. We have to spread the word. The window is closing. It is amazing that I can pick up a microphone or step in front of the computer and be able to talk to a guy in Japan and record a conversation. And then anybody can hear it. And I can go here to the studios of the Portland Radio Authority and record. And then anybody can hear it. So please help me make other people hear it. It's Bad Friday, April 10th, 2009. This has been episode 118 of MediaMonarchy.com. We first note, of course, always, that my man Webster Griffin Tarpley, of course, author of three indispensable books, Obama, The Postmodern Coup, Barack H. Obama, The Unauthorized Biography, and now the second edition of his very prescient 1999 book called Surviving the Cataclysm. How to Survive, of course, the Greatest Depression in History. Like my man Webster Tarpley says, get active or get radioactive. But the way we're going to go out here, my friends, is noting that just because you're paranoid, don't mean they're not after you. Take care.
Come on, people now! Call on your brother! Everybody get together! Try to love one another right now! Where are you?
whether you went on with the diary, or whether he did not cooperate, made no difference. The thought police would get him just the same.